I know that we have plenty of time today, but I think we can get started. So let me start by reminding you about what we saw yesterday. I gave you an argument based on a decoupling limit that n equals 4 is un super young Mills theory in 4 dimensions. It's equivalent to type 2D strings on ADS5 plus 5. We saw that the relationship between the parameters that specify the theories is this one here. So the size of both of these spaces in string units is proportional to the tooth coupling in the gauge theory. And the string coupling constant is proportional to G squared Young Mills. Okay? We also saw that a natural or a convenient way for the purpose of these lectures to write the metric on ADS5 is this one here. And this is a very good way of writing the metric because it makes it explicit that what you're doing is writing ADS5, foliating ADS5 by slices that are copies of Minkowski space in 1 plus 3 dimensions. But the scale by which you're multiplying each of those copies changes as you move in the radial direction. Okay? To make that more precise, we saw that one of the particular symmetry transformations, of course the symmetries on both sides match, and one of those symmetries is the dilatation symmetry, which you have on this side because this is an exactly conformal field theory, non-perturbative at the quantum level. So it's invariant under dilatations. The physics at any energy scale is the same, or any length scale. And that's implemented by this transformation that just free scales the coordinates. But in order for that to leave the metric invariant, we saw that we have to rescale also the radial plane. Okay? Provided we do this transformation, this is an exact isometry of this metric. Okay. But by looking at this transformation, we argued that going to long distances or low energies corresponds to going to small values of r, close to r equals 0. And therefore, physics in the bulk means the string description in ADS, that takes place around this region, corresponds to long distance or infrared physics in the gauge theory. Okay? We will see many examples of this, and this is one of the most important statements about the way the duality works. Whereas, if you're doing, say, for example, string scattering up here, graviton scattering, say, that has to do with high energy physics in the gauge theory, because you're going to large values of r, and that's called the ultraviolet, and that's where the boundary of the Esita space is. And I forgot to say, and that's important, that you can think of this theory as formulated at the boundary, or living at the boundary of the Esita space. That's not necessary, but it's a very good way of thinking about the duality. Why? Because any r equal constant slice of the Esita space is a copy of Minkowski space. Okay, so in particular, if I take the copy at infinity, I'm of course formulating my theory on Minkowski space, and the reason I take it to live at the boundary is because what is a quantum field theory? A quantum field theory, in modern language, is an ultraviolet fixed point and an RG flow. That means you specify the microscopic Lagrangian, and then the dynamics determines what happens at any of you specify it in the ultraviolet at arbitrarily high energies, and then the physics, the dynamics, determines what happens at any other energy scale. For you, in particular, you can investigate that by running the RG flow, seeing how physics changes. Okay? This UV fixed point may be a free fixed point, like a Gaussian fixed point, like in QCD. Okay? QCD is asymptotically free. Or it may be an interacting fixed point, like this case. This is an interacting for non-zero G squared n. This is an interacting but conformal field theory. That means that it's a fixed point of the normalization group flow. Okay? And in this particular theory, it has a trivial RG flow because as you flow, the physics at any energy scale is the same. But we are going to see later, probably this afternoon, an example of when we add, for example, finite temperature, that that's not going to be the case. So there will be a non-trivial running of the physics with the scale. Is this clear? So the reason I choose to think of the theory as living at the boundary is because I'm thinking of defining the theory in the modern language in the ultraviolet. Okay? And then this running here is encoded in the way the geometry changes when you move in the radial direction. Okay?
Yes. Can you just explain again why the ultraviolet is when R is infinity?
Yes. That's because suppose we know the physics at a given length scale, x. And now I ask, how does that physics change when I go to the ultraviolet? What does that mean? That means going to shorter distances or higher energies. Shorter distances I can achieve by starting with the x you gave me and multiplying it, rescaling it, by a lambda that's very small and contracting the length scale. But that, on the radial coordinate, is actually dividing by a number that's very small, so actually making it r large. So I'm moving in this direction. And vice versa. Yes?
If you take some finite r,
yes,
instead of r at infinity, the boundary, would the theory on the boundary on the hypersurface be exactly conformal?
If you... Okay. Let me rephrase your question slightly. You could ask, what happens... So you could, for example, forget about what happens above a certain energy scale and say, I'm only going to worry about what happens below a certain radial position, which means below a certain energy in the gauge theory. That you should think of as defining your theory with a cutoff, with an ultraviolet cutoff. That's what it means to cut the physics at a given energy scale. You say your theory is only defined up to this scale.
Which breaks the conformal
symmetry. That breaks the conformal symmetry. Indeed, because you're introducing a scale, but in a kind of trivial way. In this theory, you can remove that cutoff and still be left with a finite and interacting conformal theory. But you can't always do that. So, and we will see examples of this. Very good. Any more questions? Okay. So, one thing that I didn't do yet, and that, of course, is the first question you should ask is, it's all very good, it's nice to say that these two theories are equivalent, but I haven't told you how you compute observables, how you relate observables on one side to the other side. If they are equivalent or dual, what that means is that any question you can ask on one side, you can also ask on the other side, and you can translate. Okay? And it's completely equivalent to calculate on one side or on the other side. So I should tell you how the information on one side translates into the other side. So in order to motivate that, so a more precise motivation, let's look at this relationship here. I said that the Young-Mills coupling constant here is given by the string coupling constant in the bulk. But remember that GS in string theory is not a fixed coupling. It's an expectation value of the dilatant. Does this sound familiar to you? Okay, so GS indeed is E to the phi, where phi is the dilatant at infinity. That's what GS means. GS is defined by the asymptotic expectation value of the dilatant. But it may change, and we will see an example where it changes, it runs with the energy as you move in the radial direction. Is this formula familiar to everybody?
Why at infinity?
Well, because that's where you define expectation values. Okay, you fix, in order to define a coupling, you fix it. You fix the so-called non-normalizable mode of that field at infinity, and then it will change. The dynamics will change. Tell you how it changes. For example, in string theory, in flat space, you could have an asymptotically flat solution, and that's at asymptotic infinity. That's where you define what the coupling is. But then in the interior, you may have a black hole, you may have a complicated geometry, and in particular, the dilatant may run, may change with the point. Okay? But if you do, for example, string scattering, then what you mean by the coupling constant is the value of the infinity. Of course, if the scattering takes place in the interior of the geometry, where the dilatant is different, then you can actually see, I'm not going to do this in detail, but if you look at the worksheet action for the string, you can see that the effective coupling with which two strings interact is given by the value of the dilatant in the region where the interaction takes place. Okay, but as a definition of what, so this is what I'm saying is the coupling constant is not really in string theory. But what I mean by GS, by normalization, is the value at infinity. We normalize the value at infinity, we call it GS, and then G effective at a given position, right, is going to be GS e to the phi, because I have already factored out e to the phi at infinity. Okay?
I think some people never saw this one.
This?
That's pretty new.
That's pretty new? Okay, you should have all seen that, but okay. So let me give you a quick argument for this. For why actually the effective coupling is given by this. So in string theory, you know that you have to, what you're instructed to do is to compute a path integral over the string embeddings in space-time, okay, of e to the minus, in Euclidean signature, minus s, where s is a string action. Okay? Now this s has, schematically, a piece that's dx squared. Yes? But then, if your string is propagating in a background where, in particular, the dilaton is not constant, then there is a coupling between the dilaton and the Ricci scalar on the worksheet. This is the two-dimensional curvature on the worksheet. Okay? So now, the point is that we're in two dimensions. This is a, this axis is integrated in two dimensions. Okay? That's a string worksheet action. Now, in two dimensions, there's a theorem, let me just, that tells you that if you integrate the Ricci scalar over a two-dimensional worksheet up to numerical factors, what you get is the Euler complex. Yes? Okay. So now suppose that you're in a situation in which phi is constant, for simplicity. Okay? Then this bit here, phi comes out, and what I get is that the action is multiplied by e to the minus phi times chi. So here again, phi. Okay? So what I get is an action, and in fact I can pull it out of the integral because I already, this is a constant. So what I get is e to the minus phi times chi times the same path integral I have. Okay? And remember, you are in fact instructed to sum over all Riemann surfaces. Okay, when you compute a string scattering, for example, you have to compute loop corrections. So here you have to sum over sigmas. That's actually a bad notation. Riemann surfaces. Or of the genus, if you like. Or over chi. Okay, you're supposed to sum over all topologies. But you see that, and here you have a GS to the power 1 minus chi. Okay? So the string partition function is a sum over topologies, and for each topology you have to integrate, do a path integral over maps from that Riemann surface into spacetime. So you see that what this is doing is shifting what you call GS. Okay? Is this clear? It's renormalizing or changing what you're calling GS. By what amount? By e to the phi. Okay? So that's why the G effective is, if you like, GS, what you call GS that you thought was constant, times e to the phi. Is this argument clear? So if you accept that there is this coupling on the worksheet, okay, which you can argue, but I'm not going to go into those details, but if you accept that, then just by looking at the way you would compute the partition function, you see that the effective coupling is actually not GS, but GS e to the phi. Is this clear?
What about chi?
Sorry?
What about chi?
No, chi, so what this is doing is you group together this here, and here you have GS to the minus chi. So this is Gs e to the phi to the chi. Okay? So the effective, G effective is Gs e to the phi. I'm still summing over topologies, but I'm saying that the weight I give to each topology has changed. Okay? Yes?
Yeah,
yes.
So wasn't the dilaton one of the excitations of the string?
Exactly.
So if we could get that from the binomial, just the action Vx squared, why is there another term in the action rule?
No, so you should think of this in the following way. If you take the string and you quantize it in flat space, perturbatively, you get a spectrum that includes the graviton, the beam in new field, the Nevesor function of two form, the dilaton, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? That's in flat space. Now, once you have those fields, you can ask yourself, is it now consistent to consider a string that propagates in a background where those fields have an expectation boundary? Okay? That's what it means to propagate in a curved background. A curved background is a condensate, if you like, gravitons. Okay? So when you, and then you, but then you have to generalize your string action, because in flat space, the string doesn't couple to anything because there's nothing in the background, just flat space with no matter. If you now have a curved background with a non-trivial dilaton, the string action has extra pieces because now, of course, in flat space this is zero, so this coupling is not there. But in a background you have to consider it. And in fact, this dx squared in flat space, this is contracted with a flat metric, but in a curved background, this is contracted with a space-time metric, which is curved. Okay. And then once you ask that question, you realize that in a curved background with a non-trivial dilaton, the effective coupling constant is this one. Okay, so by convention, we will call Gs the value at infinity, and then everything else we will call e to the phi. Okay? Very good. Any more questions? Okay, so I was saying, that what I'm calling Gs is e to the psi at infinity. Now, this shows that if I change the value at infinity over here, of the dilaton, I'm changing Gs, and I'm changing, therefore, g squared down minus. Okay? This suggests that changing the value at infinity of the string fields, in particular the supergravity fields, corresponds to changing the coupling constants in this gauge theory. Okay, changing the coefficients of the operators in the Lagrangian of this theory. Is this clear? So, therefore, we conjecture that coupling constants in the gauge theory are in one-to-one correspondence with fields, or more precisely, with values of string fields at infinity. And that changing the value of these fields corresponds to changing the value of these coupling constants. But we can do something even more general. These fields at infinity don't have to approach a constant. They could approach something that is a function of x. Okay, so these fields are functions of x and r. When I send r to infinity, this could approach a non-trivial function phi of x. So when I take the limit r going to infinity, this approaches some little phi of x. In this case, what I'm doing is deforming the theory, not by just changing a constant, but by adding actually a source. Okay, what I'm doing is deforming the action in the gauge theory by adding a source for some operator in the theory. Let me explain this. If phi of x is a constant, okay, then this bit here is just some operator in the gauge theory times a constant. And changing this constant is changing a coupling constant, because it's a constant multiplying an operator. Okay? This could be, for example, this could be trace of F squared. Okay, in the Lagrangian. So if I change the coefficient, I'm changing the coupling constant. But more generally, I can add any number of operators I want, multiply them by a source. Okay, when this is not a constant, it's called a source. And what I'm doing is deforming the theory by adding a source. And this is what you have to do if you want to compute correlation functions, as I'll say in a second. But this actually suggests that we should generalize this and say that there is a one-to-one correspondence between local gauge invariant operators, because this is a gauge theory, so you have to look at gauge invariant quantities in the gauge theory, and fields in ABS. In such a way that we should think of the value at the boundary of each of these fields as a source for this. Okay? So I give you some field here, for example, the dilaton. And if you look at the value of this field at the boundary, that's acting as a source for some operator associated to that field. Now, how you identify the specific operator dual to a specific field, that's, in some cases, that's not trivial. But I will give you some examples in which it's easy to do that. For example, the dilaton is dual precisely to trace of F squared, plus some bits. Yes? Okay, that's the conjecture. And then if you make this conjecture, which you can test, then there's a very natural formulation of the equivalence between these two theories, which is the following. What we're going to say is that the partition function on each side is the same, even though they have different meanings. So the conjecture is that the partition function in the CFT, the gauge theory, as a function of all the possible sources you could add for all the possible operators, this is equal to the partition function on the string side with the condition that you calculated with a boundary condition, which is that phi at the boundary is equal to phi of x. So let me explain this. First of all, let's look at what data you need to define each of these partition functions. On the gauge theory side, the partition function, this z, is defined in the following way. You have to compute a path integral over all the fields in your theory, say, for example, the gluons, etc. Let me write it like this. Of e to the I times s of a. This is the gauge theory action. Okay? But this is the partition function in the presence of sources. Okay? So here we have something of the form phi of x O of x. This is in fact a sum of all possible sources for all possible operators. Why do we do it this way? Why do we compute this partition function? Because if you now take this and you functionally differentiate it with respect to phi, each time you take a functional derivative, that brings out an O over here. So what that's doing is computing expectation values of operators in the gauge theory. Okay? So let me write it down. If you want to compute O of x1, O of xn, what you have to do is take the functional derivative of log z to get the connected correlator with respect to phi of x1, phi of xn, and then evaluate it at phi equals 0. Is this clear to everybody? So if I know how to compute this object, This is a generating function, if you like, for correlation functions. If I know how to compute this, then this encodes for me every single piece of information I can ever want to compute in the gauge theory, because it encodes every possible correlation function in this conformal field theory. Okay? So you see that in order to compute this, this is a functional of what? Of all the possible sources I can add for all the possible operators. So it depends. Okay, it's not a number, it's a functional of these sources. Okay? How about this side? Well, on this side, I also have to compute a partition, an integration, a functional integral, over all possible string fields, including the supergravity fields and all the massive fields, in ABS. But ABS has a boundary. So in order to perform that path integral, I have to specify boundary conditions for my fields at the boundary. Otherwise, I don't know exactly over what type of fields I have to integrate. I have to specify a boundary condition. So you see that this type is also a functional of the same type of data, because for each of these fields, when I take the path integral, I have to specify its value at the boundary. So these two partition functions actually depend, are functionals of the same type of data in this, and of the same number of functions. If this is true, if for each operator, if there is one-to-one correspondence between operators and fields, then for each source I can add here, there is a dual field here for which I need to specify a boundary condition. Any questions about this? Very good. Yes?
The partition function on the right-hand side, that's the supergravity plus the massive mode.
That, in principle, is the exact string partition function, so which includes all the string fields.
The thing that you wrote down earlier in the sense of Riemann and some of Riemann surfaces, right? In school.
Hmm.
So we have two partition functions there.
Well, not exactly. I mean, this is really a second quantized partition function, meaning it's the string field theory partition function. Okay, where I wrote that was the partition function on the worksheet. If what I just said sounds like outlandish to everybody, don't worry about it. Okay, just think of string theory. It's more than that, but for this purpose, just think of it as a collection, an infinite collection of fields that includes the supergravity fields, which are the massless modes, and a tower of fields. And you're supposed to integrate over all of them. Okay? And each of them has a dual operator over here. Okay? Yes?
And can you think of this as the source, as like the value of the dilaton at any point on the boundary? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. For example, you could say, I'm going to consider a gauge theory in which the coupling constant is not constant over the gauge theory direction, but I'm going to let it change. For example, over here, it's stronger than over here. Okay? That's a bit of an exotic theory, but you could do that. That corresponds to a dilaton over here, such that when it approaches the boundary, it doesn't go to the same value here and here. Okay, that would be an inhomogeneous gauge theory, but that's okay. In fact, you could also formulate the gauge theory on a curved background here. You could change the metric and say it doesn't live in Minkowski space anymore. It lives in a curved metric. And that corresponds to the five-dimensional metric approaching the boundary and giving you, at the boundary, a metric that's not constant. Okay? We're not going to do that, but you could. Yes?
So in general, if you have two functions that depend on the same variables, that doesn't mean that they're the same functions.
No, of course not. Otherwise, this would be an empty statement.
So I guess I'm curious. Is this equality is still postulated rather than proven? Or
at this level, this is postulated, and then it's everybody's job to test the conjecture to the point that you can. And this is why I was saying, just this is not a proven equivalence. But there's a lot of evidence that it is correct. And we will see some of it. Okay. Now, this object here, as you can imagine, is very hard to compute in general. Okay, integrating over all string theory fields, etc., that's not an easy calculation. But there is a limit in which this object dramatically simplifies. That limit is the classical supergravity limit. So if you take g squared n to be very large, remember I told you yesterday that in that limit, the radius of the space is much bigger than the string length, so you can forget about all the massive, all the tower of modes of the string, and just concentrate on the massless parts. So what that does is to truncate the theory to supergravity. Quantum supergravity still, but if you then send g squared Young Mills to zero, then the gs goes to zero, then that further reduces the simplification to classical supergravity. Okay, so in the limit, can I erase that here? So in the limit, lambda equals g squared by mills nc going to infinity, and with g squared by mills going to zero and nc going to infinity, in this limit, string theory reduces to classical supergravity. Okay? So in a classical theory, the way you calculate the partition function is just by looking at a classical solution and plugging it into the action. Okay? So in this limit, log of z string, or if you like, z string is simply e to the minus s, the classical action of supergravity, evaluated on a classical solution. For example, suppose you want to compute correlation functions. Suppose you want to compute this. Two-point function of trace of f squared in the gauge theory, in the conformal theory. Okay. First of all, what do I have to do? I have to identify the field in string theory that's dual to this operator. Okay. This is my operator O of x, and this I just told you in this particular case is dual to the limit. Okay. So to compute the two-point function, I need to imagine that I'm adding here, that I'm adding a source, phi of x, for trace of f squared in the partition function, in the conformal field theory, and that I take two functional derivatives. But this partition function in the gauge theory is very difficult to compute in this limit because the coupling constant is very large. But I can compute it on the other side because on that side, everything is classical. So what I do is I solve the equation of motion for the dilaton, the classical equation of motion for the dilaton, here, with a boundary condition that this approaches a specific but arbitrary function at the boundary. Okay, this is my boundary condition for my Laplace equation over here for the dilaton. I solve it, and then I plug it into the supergravity action, which depends on many fields, in particular on the dilaton. And I get some result that is a functional of the boundary condition I impose, because for each different boundary condition is a different solution, and therefore I get a different on-shell action. Okay? And then I take two functional derivatives of this with respect to phi of x, and that's exactly this correlator. It's as easy as that. Doing that, you're computing a highly quantum, strongly coupled two-point function in a theory that you have no idea how to compute, in general, okay, in some cases you can use some other methods, but in general we don't know how to compute stone coupling in a quantum theory. Whereas we are mapping that problem to a classical problem, as simple as solving a Laplace equation in a rather simple metric. Okay? That's the power of this duality. Very good. Any questions?
Comment on I on the exponential.
Say that again?
Can you make a comment on the absence of the I in the exponential?
Yeah, this is the Euclidean formulation. Yeah. I apologize, I'm being sloppy between jumping between Euclidean and Lorentzian. Sometimes I write e to the is, sometimes e to the minus s, but allow me that license. Okay, so there is one particular, I told you that in general it's not obvious what field is dual to what operator. But there is one particular case in which we know extra information that allows us to do that. Of course, the way you do it in general is, for example, if you're looking at a scalar operator, then the dual field has to be scalar operator. They have to have the same quantum numbers. Okay? If it's a vector operator or a spinor operator, the dual field has to be a vector or a spinor, etc. They have to have the same Lorentz quantum numbers, etc., etc. Now, there's one extra piece of information that's very useful, which is the following. There is a particularly interesting class of operators in a cage theory, which are conserved currents. If your theory has global symmetries, then you have conserved currents. Okay? Say of this form. This turns out are always dual, J mu of X. To gauge fields on ABS. Okay? In such a way that when you take the limit are going to infinity, that's what defines J mu of X. Okay? Sorry, that's the source for K mu of X. Why is this true? This is true because of, again, a very deep and important property of the way the duality works, which is the following. Remember that yesterday we saw that the symmetries, the global symmetries here and here, are the same. Okay? In particular, we looked at this and we said that the symmetries are the isometries of this space. And that gave us SO2,4 times SO2. But of course, gravity or string theory on this space has a much larger group of symmetries. In particular, it includes diffeomorphism symmetries. Okay? So what's the relation between that and these isometries? Well, what I said, I was avoiding a subtlety, which is the fact that the isometries really here, that are physical symmetries, are the large gauge transformations. So you should think of the isometries. Okay, you know gauge transformations when you go to infinity can either go to the identity. Okay, a gauge transformation is a symmetry transformation that depends on the point. So if when you go to infinity the transformation goes to the identity, that's called a small gauge transformation. If it goes to something that's non-trivial, that's not the identity, it's called a large gauge transformation. Is this nomenclature clear? Okay. Now, small gauge transformations are not really symmetries. They are redundancies in the description. Okay? The physics is gauge invariant. Is this clear again? Okay, in quantum in electrodynamics, the gauge symmetry is not really a symmetry because I can just fix the gauge. Okay? It doesn't really map a state, a physical state, to a different physical state. Whereas global symmetries, okay, or large gauge transformations that change the boundary condition at infinity, those are physical transformations that map one state to another. Is this clear again to everybody? Okay. In this context, that's very important. Because string theory contains gravity, and gravity is diffeomorphism invariant. So all the coordinate transformations that you can perform here that approach the identity when you go to the boundary, those are not physical transformations. Okay? They don't change one state into another. Only those that approach, when you approach the boundary, don't go to a trivial transformation, those are large gauge transformations, and those are physical. And it's those that actually match exactly the global transformations over here. So if you have a diffeomorphism transformation here that when you approach the boundary approaches an asymptotic isometry of this space, that is a large gauge transformation, and that corresponds, matches one-to-one with the global symmetries over here. Okay? So a consequence of what I'm saying is that it is true that every global symmetry transformation here maps to a global symmetry transformation here, but every global transformation here happens to be the large gauge transformation, which is part of an overall and much bigger gauge symmetry group. Is that clear? Let me say it again. The only global transformations here are always of the form a large gauge transformation. Every global transformation has associated to it a gauge transformation. It's really a gauge transformation that happens to be large. But the fact that it's a large gauge transformation tells you that there is a gauge field associated to that symmetry. Okay? So that means that, and you see how things match, global symmetries of the gauge theory of the CFT correspond to large gauge transformations of string theory on ADS 5 plus 5. Okay? But in particular, because they are a large gauge transformation and not just any global transformation, we know that to each of these there is an associated gauge field. Yes? That implements the gauge transformation, just a second. But on the other hand, any global transformation in the conformality theory has a conserved quantity that's implemented by a conserved current. And this is the current that's due precisely to this gauge field that implements the transformation. Is this clear? This is, I'm emphasizing this because this is a point that's hardly ever discussed in the literature. Okay? But it's important because it explains why conserved currents are dual to gauge fields. Just a second, let me finish. And also, it's consistent with a general belief that, as far as I know, is not really proven, but it's a general belief that in any theory of quantum gravity, the only conserved quantities are those associated to large gauge transformations. And this is a particular example, a realization of that. Okay? Good, you have a question.
Yeah, can you just give an example of a large gauge transformation and a small gauge transformation? Just to...
Yes. You take... let's see. Take a diffeomorphism, for example, that does the following thing. It sends x to 1 plus 1 over r x and leaves r invariant. This is a small gauge transformation because when you approach the boundary, so everywhere in ABS, this shifts x. But when r goes to infinity, it goes to 0 and you're not shifting x. So it approaches the identity. Okay? But if I put, r plus 1 over r here, then when I approach the boundary, this doesn't go to the identity because I'm rescaling x. Okay? So this at the boundary approaches dilatation, for example. Or more simply, if you put x plus r over r plus 1 times a constant, say a. Okay? When you approach the boundary, this is just a translation. Is this clear, the difference? Do you have a question?
I have the same question.
Okay. Very good. So, the conclusion is that conserved currents have as sources in the gauge theory the boundary value of gauge fields. So remember I wrote before that this is what we were doing. Okay, I was deforming the gauge theory by adding an operator with a given source, complete correlation functions. In this particular case, this bit takes the form A mu of x, J mu of x, where this A mu, okay, I'm using a slight abuse of notation, this A mu of x here is really the limit when r goes to infinity of A mu of x and r. Okay? So if you want to compute the messages, if you want to compute correlation functions of conserved currents, what you have to do is solve equations of motion here for gauge fields. Okay? And notice that this coupling here is gauge invariant because J mu is conserved. And this is another consistency check of this correspondence. Because A mu, I just told you, is a gauge field in the bulk. You have to see the space. This five-dimensional field is a gauge field. So I could shift, do a gauge transformation for A mu. And this coupling had better be invariant, because otherwise I'm getting gauge-dependent physics. Okay? But if you shift, so under, if delta A mu is, say, V mu of some function F for our given gauge field, then if you plug this into here, you will see that delta of this is proportional, it's essentially integrating by parts, is this thing. And this is zero, because this is a conserved current. Okay. Now, in any gauge theory that's invariant under translations, there's a very important conserved set of currents, which is the energy momentum tensor. Okay? So one important case is 2 meters. Can anybody tell me a guess for the dual field in anti-Sitter space? This is an operator in the gauge theory that's conserved. So what is the dual field to this operator? Any guesses? You can look at my lecture, but I have told you. Okay, what's the spin of this field, of this operator? Is it a scalar operator? No, is it a spin one operator? What is it? Spin two operator. Symmetric and spin two. Do you know any fields that we always have in closed string theory that has spin two and is a gauge field? The gravity, right? The gravity is the gauge field that implements the diffeomorphism invariance. Okay? So the dual to this is G mu nu of X and R. And so this coupling, in that case, is of the form G mu nu of X. This is the boundary value of the metric of X and R times G mu nu. So one thing that's very important that we will see this afternoon is, in certain gauge theories, computing correlation functions of the strength energy momentum tensor. And in order to do that, all you need is to solve the Einstein equations, because what's the equation of motion for the metric? It's the Einstein equation, in a Dirac-Sitter space with given boundary conditions at the boundary. And another thing is that this tells you that in any theory that is translationally invariant, By translation invariance, you know that there's a conserved energy momentum tensor. And therefore, the dual description must involve dynamical gravity. Because the dual field to this operator must be a gauge field, therefore a massless spin to field in a physical space. OK, any more questions about this? Very good. So in that case, let me be a bit more precise about this, because actually there is a subtlety here that's important. Okay? I told you that all you have to do is take the whatever field you're looking at in a theta space and take the limit when r goes to infinity, and from that read off phi of x. Okay? But that's not exactly like that. So let me explain that. And it's not exactly like that because when you solve the equation of motion for one of these fields, you realize that it doesn't approach a finite value at the boundary in general. So you have to be careful with what you mean by the boundary value. So naively, as I said, you would say, so this is naive and wrong, you would say that you just define the source in this way. Okay. However, when you solve the equation of motion for one of the fields that lives here, in general what you find is that this goes like some function of x over r to some power plus another function phi tilde over r to a different power plus subleading terms. And what I mean is that here alpha is bigger than beta. Okay? And in order to solve the equation of motion, you need to specify these two boundary, two boundary conditions. This one, which is natural because you're solving typically a second order differential equation. This mode here is called the non-normalizable mode of this field because it falls off more slowly than this one. So typically, this one is not normalizable. Okay? If you set it to zero, what you get is something normalizable. And this one is called a normalizable form. Sorry, I said it wrong here. Beta is bigger than alpha. Okay? This one falls off faster than this one. For example, in one of the exercises, I ask you to solve the equation of motion for a scalar field here near the boundary. That's all you need to know, because the only thing you're interested in for this discussion is the asymptotic falloff of the field. Okay? So if you do it, example, if you do it for a scalar field of mass m, where this is the mass in five dimensions, okay? It's the mass of the field here. Then you find that if you assume that phi x and r is of the form e to the I k x, because you want it to have a definite, well-defined momentum in the gauge theory directions, times r to the gamma, okay, so gamma q would be minus alpha or minus beta, then you find that this gamma satisfies this condition. Where r is the radius of the space where the field is propagating. Okay, so this equation, given the mass of the field, determines the two possible values of gamma. Okay, determines alpha and beta. So alpha is the biggest root of this equation and beta is the smallest. Sorry, beta is the biggest one and alpha is the smallest. So you see that if I want to get something finite at infinity, I cannot just take this limit. I have to multiply phi by r to the minus alpha, to the alpha, in order to get something finite. Yes.
So it's possible for alpha to be negative, in fact.
To have what?
It's possible for alpha to be negative, so that, is that why you're putting it non-normalizable? If alpha is negative, then it's a it blows up at infinity.
It, I'm not sure off the top of my head if this can be negative, but it doesn't need to be negative in order for this to be non-normalizable. Yeah.
Is there other factors of R in
the integer? Well, there are factors of R that come from the definition of a scalar product for fields in this space. Yeah. I mean, notice that the metric is blowing up when you go to large R. So the conclusion is that in order to get something finite, the correct definition is to say that phi of x is the limit when R goes to infinity of R to the alpha, where alpha is the smallest root, times phi of x and a half. Okay? But this already tells you what type of object is this phi. So if this is a scalar field, then this is not just a scalar field, it's a scalar density of a given dimension. Why? Because remember, that I'm multiplying it by r to the alpha. But remember that under dilatations, r changes to r over lambda. Okay? So this tells you that phi of x, that phi changes to r to the, sorry, lambda to the minus alpha times phi. In other words, it transforms as a scalar density with dimension length to the minus alpha, or equivalently, mass to the alpha. Okay? What I'm telling you is what is the dimension of this source. Yes? Similarly, you can just see that the dimension of phi tilde is therefore going to be L to the minus beta or M to the beta, mass to the power. And then if you look at the fact that for phi in particular, remember that I said that phi corresponds to deforming the theory by adding an additional operator with a source. So, and this is integrated over d4x. This is a gauge theory coupling. So if phi has dimensions of mass to the alpha, then this has dimensions of length to the fourth. And the whole thing has to be a scalar. So O has to have dimension m to the four, sorry, to the alpha, to the alpha minus four, right? No, 4 minus alpha. That's right, 4 minus alpha. Okay? So O has mass dimension 4 minus alpha. Let's see if this is correct. So phi has dimensions n to the alpha. Multiplied by this, I get m to the 4th. And this is length to the 4th. Okay? 1 over 4. So I get a scale. Okay? Let's check if this is correct for a massless scalar, like the dilaton. Okay? Remember I told you, let me erase. No, wait. Okay. Now, for a scalar mass of mass n equals 0, I get 0 here. Okay? So the two solutions are 0 and minus 4. Okay, so this means that alpha is 0, or the other way around. Oh no, that's right. This is r to the gamma. So, but here I'm writing it as 1 over r to the alpha. Okay, so gamma is minus alpha or minus beta. Okay? So, alpha is 0 and beta is 4. Yes? Does everybody see this? Very good. So the smallest root, which determines the non-normalizable mode, is alpha, which is 0. And therefore, in this case, phi, the dilaton, or the source associated to the dilaton, has dimension m to the 0. And therefore, the dual operator has to have dimension m to the 4th. It's a marginal operator. Okay? Is this true? Well, I said that the dual of the dilaton is also dual to trace f squared to this operator. What's the dimension of this operator? 4. Why? Because f is d of a, right? F mu nu is d mu a nu plus a. Yes? If you have a gauge field in 4 dimensions that's canonically normalized, what's the dimension of a field?
0?
1. Why? Because the action, what's the action? The action is essentially a quarter with a minus trace f squared, d4x. Yes? And this has to be a scalar. So this has dimensions length to the fourth, so this has dimensions mass to the fourth, but this is d of a, this is 1 over length.
You just said trace f squared has mass to the fourth, so
yeah. Very good, yes. No, but I'm trying to tell you how you read of the dimension of the field of the gauge field, okay? So a gauge field in 4 dimensions always has dimension Markov. Okay, so this is consistent for a scalar, for a massless scalar like the dilaton, the dual is a marginal operator, okay? And that's important because this is telling you that the dimension of the operators in the gauge theory, which is very important because it's very important to know if an operator is marginal, relevant or irrelevant. Is this clear to everybody? That is related to the mass of the dual field. Okay, so if you vary the mass of the field dual to a given operator, you're changing the dimension. Okay? And you also see that if you're looking at fields over here that are very, very massive, for example, the whole tower of string fields, those have masses that are very large. Those correspond to dual operators of very large dimension, okay? Because here you get a big number. All right, so the solutions are large numbers. So if the dimension of the dual operator is very large, it means it's very irrelevant, okay? So it's very unimportant at low energies, as you would expect, because very massive string fields should not play such a role at very low energies, okay? Okay, so we're almost done. I told you that phi is dual to a source. It's associated to a source. And what the dimension of the operator is. So what is the interpretation of this mode? So that's the non-normalizing mode. Okay? What is the interpretation of this one? This one actually corresponds not to deforming the theory by having a source, but to vacuum expectation values of operators. Okay? How do we see that? Well, let's apply. First of all, is it consistent? For example, in this case, what I'm claiming is that for the dilaton, this mode has the interpretation of the vacuum expectation value of the corresponding operator. Is this consistent in terms of dimensions? Yes, because, see, if O is trace of F squared, then this vacuum expectation value has dimensions of mass to the fourth. Yes? Yes, mass to the fourth. But somewhere I had written that the dimension of phi tilde was m to the beta. Remember? But beta, in this case, is 4. So it's consistent. Okay? Phi can be consistently interpreted as the vacuum expectation of this operator because it has the correct dimension as the operator. Okay? This is very important. The fact that the non-normalizable mode corresponds to deforming the Lagrangian of the theory, and the normalizable mode corresponds to giving vacuum expectation values to operators. Okay? And the reason that's important is the following. At the beginning, I told you that these two modes are the two boundary conditions you need to impose on the solution of a second-order differential equation. So you might think that they are independent. Yes? However, in general, they are not. Because if you solve the equation with arbitrary values of this and that, then that, typically, when you go to the interior, will develop a singularity. It will not be a regular solution. If you impose, for example, that the solution is regular around here, that only happens for a specific combination of this guy and that guy, as is typical when you solve second-order differential equations. Okay? Only a specific combination of the two independent solutions is regular everywhere. What does that mean? It means that I can think of this as being determined by regularity once I specify that. Okay? For each value of this, I'm not free anymore to choose this guy. It's determined by the condition that the solution is regular in the interior. Yes? That's exactly what you should expect. Because if I specify for you this mode, I'm telling you what the Lagrangian of the theory is. I'm telling you what source I'm adding for what operator. I'm completely defining the Lagrangian. If I do that, then all the vacuum expectation values should be determined by the dynamics. Once you specify the Hamiltonian, the theory determines for you if a given operator acquires a depth or not. Okay? Very good. So that corresponds to this being determined by that. So it's consistent with what I'm saying. And then, to finish, let me show that this is correct. And this will be the first application of the recipe I gave you to compute correlation functions. Note that this is one particular correlation function. It's a one-point function. Okay. Before I talk about two-point functions. So how do we compute that? Well, remember that I said that to compute correlation functions, in particular one-point function, you have to differentiate with respect to the source. The supergravity action and evaluate it at phi equals zero, at zero source. But the supergravity action takes for a scalar field, okay, if you truncate it and you only allow one scalar field to be very non-trivially, schematically, this takes the following form. This is just an integral over ABS. Phi times the sphere, but it doesn't play a role here, of d phi squared. But this integrated by parts on shell, when you evaluate it on shell, if you integrate by parts, you get a piece, that's the equation of motion, plus a boundary term. The equation of motion, when you evaluate it on a solution, is zero. Okay, because that's the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion. So on shell, this reduces to a boundary term, which is just of the form, an integral of the boundary of phi d phi. Okay? Now, if you take this expression and you plug it in here, and you look at the behavior at the leading terms near the boundary, because this is evaluated at the boundary, at large r, then this becomes, this has a piece that goes like phi squared, because this is the leading term, and this is quadratic, okay? So the leading term is phi squared. Sorry, little phi now, because I'm evaluating at the boundary, plus phi tilde, plus sub-leading terms, like phi tilde squared, etc. Yes? But now take this object, take a functional derivative with respect to phi, and evaluate at phi equals zero. This term is quadratic, so the derivative is proportional to itself. So when I set phi equals zero, this goes to zero, the derivative. And this one, when I differentiate with respect to phi, gives me phi tilde. Okay? So what I get here is that this goes like phi tilde. But this was precisely the one-point function. Okay? So this mode determines the vacuum expectation function, as I said. Yes?
Okay, so why is the expectation value not the derivative of e to the minus s?
Because That is not, because what I want is the generating function of connected correlators.
Oh, okay.
Right? Which is derivative of log of the partition function, which is S. Remember, Z was e to the minus S?
Yeah.
And in fact,
but it was the sum of e to the minus S.
This is, so this is minus log of Z.
Okay,
Z is e to the minus S.
But it's the integral of e to the minus S.
Yes, but when you evaluate it on the classical solution, you don't actually perform the path integral. That would give you a determinant. Okay.
Okay.
The classical, in the semi-classical approximation, you have. Well, I'm out of time, so I'll tell you afterwards. Any questions? Okay, so it's 12:30. I've said everything I wanted to say about this, and the only thing I wanted to add was something about Wilson loops. Because everything I've told you holds for local gauge invariant operators. Local. What? O of X. But in a gauge theory, you can define non-local gauge invariant operators like Wilson loops. Now, I'm out of time, so I should leave it, and you can explain it to them.
Well, we've done it.
You've done Wilson loops? Yes. Okay, there's an exercise called Wilson loops, so maybe I should stop here, right?
Might make a good homework, actually, but we'll see.
Okay.
We'll talk about loops.
Yeah, maybe I'll just finish it off this afternoon. Okay. Yes.